Well, good evening. Welcome to the end of our three-part series on the Middle East. And I tell you, this has been hard to keep up. I mean, it seems like every couple of days, the whole situation changes. So, but I believe that we will get a snapshot of things as they are, as of right now, and kind of look at what comes down the road, what comes next. So let me say a prayer for us, and we're going to dive in. Lord, thank you for the privilege we have of living in this country. We're grateful for the freedoms that we have. And Father, we know this nation has yet to achieve its ideals. And nevertheless, I pray that you would help us to be agents of justice, agents of peace. I pray for our leaders, Lord, that we might seek peace in the world. I pray, Father, that you would strengthen them, that you would turn their hearts toward you, that this nation might be a beacon for you in the world. In Christ's name, amen. Well, here's the number for questions, whether you're online or here with us. Just text your questions in during class. So what we've been doing is we had a short session, three lessons, and so we thought we'd do a Middle East update. And in our first session, if you go back and watch these, all these are on the website, we talked about the Christian view of the Middle East, and particularly in light of what's called Christian eschatology, meaning Christianity thinks history's going somewhere. Not everybody thinks history is going somewhere, that it's just a cycle. If you think about Buddhism, history is a cycle. But for Christianity, history has a point. It's going somewhere. So eschatology is, where's it going and how does it end? Second session, we looked at Islam. We looked at the two major divisions in Islam, the Sunni and the Shia versions of Islam, and that split all the way back from 680 AD. We looked at some of the differences in theology, but fundamentally, we then looked at a kind of a combined Islamic eschatology. Islam also thinks that history is going somewhere, largely because Islam came about almost, 600 years after the time of Jesus. And so Muhammad was familiar with the Old Testament. He was familiar with the New Testament. And so you'll see that the Quran also has an eschatological point to it. And so the end times for Islam also involves, I mean, they're very different, but they involve a judgment and the forces of good versus evil, God versus evil in the end. In this lesson, what I'd like to do is look a little bit more at, okay, how are things today? And we will keep those ideas in our background and apply those and help understand what's happening today. So who are the players and how are things likely to turn out? Probably the fundamental question is it inevitable that there will be war in the Middle East? So that may be the guiding question for us as we move through it. So let's start with just a sketch of the Middle East. One of the things I'd like to point out about the Middle East is that you have nations, and so what you see on this map are the various nations in the Middle East. Those nations, 100 years ago, didn't look like that. Those nations, since World War II, didn't look like that. In fact, the boundaries of nation states in the Middle East are in pretty continual flux. One of the reasons for that is that some of the major actors in the Middle East are not nation states. They are what are called non-state actors. So for example, like today, if you listen to the news in Turkey, you'll see that the Turks and the Kurds are battling one another. Well, they both live in the geography of the nation of Turkey, but they have nothing in common. The Kurds are like, we want to be independent. We don't want to be part of Turkey. Who drew this boundary? We didn't draw this boundary. We don't agree with this boundary. So in other words, they don't see themselves so much as nation states as they see themselves as tribes or groups or ideologically aligned groups of people, non-state actors. I'll give you a great example of that that's just very recently been in the news. So Jordan, This is King Abdullah of Jordan. And Reuters just announced maybe 2 weeks ago, I think it's the last week of April, that King Abdullah had outlawed the Muslim Brotherhood. This is Muhammad Badi. He is nominally the head of the Muslim Brotherhood. However, he has been in prison in Egypt since 2013. So the Muslim Brotherhood is not a nation, it's a movement, and the Muslim Brotherhood exists across state boundaries. Nation boundaries mean nothing to them whatsoever. The King of Jordan outlawed the Muslim Brotherhood because of the potential for insurrection. And you can read the story, it's very recent, you can read it online. But that's a significant move. And so what's happening there? It is a nation saying that there is a subgroup of people whose interests don't align with our nation. And they're all Muslims. I forgot to mention that. So obviously, Abdullah's a Muslim. Muslim Brotherhood, are Muslims. And yet, you see them being outlawed and kicked out. Muslim Brotherhood's probably one that's good to talk about briefly. They were started back in the early 30s by a guy named Hassan Banna, but the Muslim Brotherhood as we know it today was shaped largely by this guy, Saeed Qutb, and this is his goal. He basically transformed the Muslim Brotherhood. It's definitely a revolutionary force, but listen to what they're aimed at. Setting up the kingdom of Allah on earth and eliminating the kingdom of man. So think about that for just a second. That is as much a threat to a Muslim nation as it is to a non-Muslim nation. And as a matter of fact, the Muslim Brotherhood has tried to overthrow at various times the government of Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Tunisia, Libya, all Muslim countries. So their vision is that nations aren't really part of the vision of the Quran, and that's true, but their point is we should all be one Islamic kingdom, if you will. And so they have been instigators to try to bring that vision about, and that has been as great a threat to Muslims as to non-Muslim nations. A number of the non-state actors today were spawned by the Muslim Brotherhood. So, for example, Hamas in Gaza used to be, 50 years ago, the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. And then they kind of broke off and went their way as the Muslim Brotherhood was being fought by the Muslim governments. And so Hamas is an offshoot. Egyptian Islamic Jihad is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood has inspired a lot of radical groups with this vision, is that let's bring the kingdom of Allah or the kingdom of God to earth and let's eliminate the kingdom of man. Let's eliminate the governments of man. And so when they look at Muslims, say in Saudi Arabia or in Jordan or in Egypt, they see people that have effectively sold out on the vision of Islam. So my point in this is that non-state actors are the primary actors, I would argue, in the Middle East. Now you're gonna see Iran is probably the one exception to that, because Iran is one state that is one mega non-state actor. Okay, but everybody else is battling different groups of people. So I thought what we would do is we'd start small with Israel, and then we'd move out. And so let's start with Israel, and let's talk about what's going on there today, and look at the different ideologies. This is a map of what Israel looks like today. So just to frame this, Israel has 10 million people. But 21% of them are Arab. They're not Jews. And in fact, in the Israeli parliament, you can fact check me on this, and I may be wrong, but I think there are two Arab representatives who don't want Israel to exist. But Israel is a democracy, parliamentary democracy, and so they have a couple of representatives in their parliament that are Arab. So 21% are Arab. This is interesting. It doesn't really affect this, but you'll find this interesting. 13% are what are usually called ultra-Orthodox. Okay, so the ultra-Orthodox are the very, very, very devout Jews. They're not the only sort of Jews, but they're very devout. One reason I put that up there, well, there's two reasons, but one is that's 34% of the population that doesn't serve in the military. So think about this. You've got 10 million citizens, not all of whom obviously are fighting eligible, fighting age, right? But 10 million, and 34% of them do not do service in the military. So you have a nation that's got maybe 6 million people, of which a much smaller number than that are eligible to fight and draw their army from. And that's why you see a citizen army in Israel. So Israel, militarily, is not very big. Compare this to Gaza, has approximately 2 million people in the Gaza Strip. West Bank, the Gaza Strip is moderately densely populated. I mean, it's not Tokyo, but it's moderately densely populated. About 3 million in the West Bank. Those are not included in the 10 million number, and they're not included in the Arabs. So kind of a side issue, one of the proposals for peace in the Middle East was to make one big state that Israel could go to the Palestinians, I'm gonna call the residents of the West Bank Palestinians because that's the common term, go to the Palestinians and say, you're all Israeli citizens and we're all in one big happy family and you get to vote and all of that kind of thing. But stop and think about this for a minute. You already have, and by the way, these Arabs are citizens. Healthcare, voting, they're citizens. So now you have about 2 million of them, 3 million in the West Bank, and a total population of 10 million. What happens when you vote? The non-Jewish part of your population is a majority. Well, needless to say, there aren't any Israelis that think, let's give our country away, you know, and let's let all the folks that don't think we ought to exist, let's let them vote. So that you don't hear much about a one-state solution. And this is why you don't hear much about a one-state solution. Israel has given citizenship to a lot of Arabs, though. So I just want to point that out because sometimes you think that Israel is only Jews, and that's not quite correct. So where are Israel's enemies? Israel's enemies are fundamentally, their immediate enemies are non-state actors. So Hezbollah in the north. Hezbollah is a non-state actor. They are not the government of Lebanon, but they are powerful enough, militaristic enough, that they do what they want in southern Lebanon. So they aren't the government, but the government can't control Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a non-state actor. In the south, and Hezbollah, by the way, is Shia. They're supported by Iran, and religiously they are Shiite. In the south, you have Hamas. Hamas is Sunni, offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. And in the West Bank, you have the Palestinian Authority. And their party is, you may hear Fatah as the party. Also Muslims. So you have three different groups who are united ideologically. They don't get along with each other, but they're united ideologically against Israel. So Israel's battle is not against a nation. It's not against a particular geography. It's against groups of people living within legitimate nations or legitimate geography. Does that make sense? That really changes the dynamic of what's going on, and we haven't seen that in America. That's not been the way battles have been fought historically. So one of the things that I want to tell you about these groups. They are radical groups, even though at the moment the Palestinian Authority is not in any significant conflict with Israel. Of course, Hamas and Hezbollah have been. So the idea of jihad is an idea that's in the Quran, and there are different types of jihad. Jihad means a struggle, and it's a struggle for Islam. It's a struggle for God, for Allah. You can do jihad of the tongue, and that is you can go become what you and I might call an evangelist, right? So you can go strive for God by trying to convince people that you should become a Muslim. When we think of jihad, we think of the particular type, and that's the jihad of the sword, right? In other words, we're going to go battle the people that are unbelievers, the people that do not submit to Allah, then we will do jihad in a violent way. Not all Muslims believe that, but these non-state actors that are driving the Middle East do. And that's the way they go about it. So here's something that causes Westerners a lot of hard to understand. So for example, when Israel goes into Gaza to fight against Hamas, where is Hamas? Hamas is firing rockets from neighborhoods. They've got arms dumps underneath hospitals. They basically use civilians as human shields. Well, from a Western point of view, we think that's just so wrong, but it effectively hobbles Israel or anyone else attempting to fight them. So it's very effective, and I wanted to give you the ideological reason for it. So if you were a Hamas fighter, your attitude would be this, and this comes directly from the Muslim Brotherhood, that some Muslims' jihad is to fight for Allah, and some Muslims' jihad is to die for Allah. So what their attitude is, that we're here and we're using these civilians as a human shield, and the bomb comes in and blows them up, that's very effective because the PR is really good, right? Israel takes a lot of heat for that. And so these civilians were being good Muslims by dying, by being blown up. That is the idea. Even to the point, the Muslim Brotherhood sometimes killed Muslims. So, for example, if the Muslim Brotherhood has a bomb and it kills, say, some Israelis, but it also kills some Muslims, their attitude is, well, good job. You died in the service of Allah. Now, nobody asked those people if that was their idea to do it, but that is the ideology. In fact, when they rebel against fellow Muslims and kill them, their idea is, we'll let Allah sort that out. So I just want you to realize that from a Western point of view, you look at Hamas and you say, that's really morally reprehensible to use human shields. From their point of view, it is not morally reprehensible. All Muslims should be involved in jihad. And if you aren't going to fight, then you'll make a good human shield. I'm not trying to trivialize it, and I'm not trying to validate it. I just want you to realize they look at this very, very differently than we do. Okay? So, question.
Yes. Do you think the West Bank will ever have a name change to Judea and Samaria?
Well, Donald Trump is going there next week and says he has a big announcement, so I don't know. All joking aside, Orthodox Jews already call the West Bank Judea and Samaria. The rest of the world, which is more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, considers it occupied territory, and consequently, I don't think that broadly speaking in the world press, you will see that change to Judea and Samaria as long as you have Palestinians living there. I mean, that's more of a labeling thing. Again, if you go to Israel and you talk to Israelis, that is Judea, Samaria. They don't acknowledge that as Palestine, per se.
How would you define Zionism? And is this considered a positive ideology from a Christian worldview or perspective?
Good question. So what is Zionism? Zionism is, I'm going to really simplify this, but Zionism was happening in the 1800s, and it was an idea that had two versions, but they both agreed on this one idea, and that is, think back when Jews are scattered all around, there's no Israel, this is back before World War II, and Jews are living everywhere, and Jews are encountering persecution around the world. And the idea that Jews need to come together for their own protection in a common homeland, and that homeland should be this land of Israel because it is part of the Jewish heritage. Zionism has two flavors. One of them is secular, meaning you could be Jewish. And by the way, Jews in Israel are not all religious. Being Jewish is an ethnic thing. You, as Christians, tend to think of Jewish as a religious thing. Not necessarily. You can be religiously Jewish. You can be ethnically Jewish. That's going to be my shorthand for that. You can be Jewish, not believe in God. So my point is, as an ethnic Jew, Zionism said, our people group deserves, needs to come back to our ancestral homeland. So that's a secular Zionism. But there are also Jews who are religious, and they said, yes, we do, but not just for protection, and it's not just our ancestral homeland. God is real, and God gave us that land. It belongs to us because God gave it to us. So there's secular and religious Zionism. And generally speaking, Christians who have that, remember that dispensational view that began to pick up in the 1800s and came into America in the 1900s, that view that God's not finished with the Jews was very favorable toward the Zionist idea that, of course, that land, the Christians would say that land is given to the Jews by God, and yes, they should be allowed to come back to that land. So generally speaking, I'm speaking broadly, but yes, generally Christians were very favorably disposed toward the Zionist idea for religious reasons. So that's a great question.
Okay, of the population of Israel and the West Bank and Gaza, how many Christians are there?
Not many. I don't have a percentage in my head, but very, very small. Now, I will tell you, though, that there are Arab Christians and Jewish Christians, meaning ethnically Jewish, but are Christians, ethnically Arabs, but are Christians. So for example, in the West Bank, Bethlehem is in the West Bank. And if you go to Bethlehem, you will see what used to be a pretty good sizable number of Palestinians who are Christian, not Muslim. And it's shrinking because there's hostility towards them. Even though they're both, quote, Palestinians, one's Muslim, one's Christian. So there are actually Christians spread through all these different ethnicities. Nevertheless, it's a very small percentage.
There appear to be Kurds in more than one country. Are they all the same people group?
Good question. Yes, the Kurds are in Turkey, the Kurds are in Syria, and the Kurds have a lot of factions. I think we talked about that a little bit in perhaps the first, I can't remember, but we talked a little bit about the Syrian situation. But yes, the Kurds are all one people group, and you can understand those nation lines were drawn by other people. And so the Kurds just weren't favorably divided. And so you got the line down the middle. Some of the Kurds are, okay, you're now in Turkey and you're Turks. And they're like, no, we're not. You're now in Syria, you're Syrians. No, we're not. And so they're fighting both governments. And so that's right. The Kurds are a people group who got split into more than one country. They don't think like that. They don't think, I'm a Turkish Kurd, I'm a Syrian Kurd. No, we're Kurds. We need our own land. And we don't want to be part of either one of these countries. So you have a lot of factions here. It's not just Muslims versus Jews. There's a lot of factions here. There's a lot of fighting amongst a lot of people. But the big fault line is really Muslim or Arab versus Jew. So that's what Israel's dealing with, is they're fundamentally fighting right on their borders three non-state actors. Those non-state actors, and this is what's really up the game, there have been non-state actors for a long time. The problem for a non-state actor is, how do I generate money? Because I don't have taxes or anything. Yeah, I mean, I probably get money from people who are favorably disposed to my cause, right? I get donations, so to speak, because I got to buy weapons and I've got to buy bullets and that sort of thing. So non-state actors have always had a hard time getting really high-tech gear. When Iran was a nation state, when the Ayatollah had the revolution in Iran in the 1970s, now all of a sudden one of these radical groups has a nation, meaning I have tax revenues, I can buy airplanes, I can buy missiles, I can hire. Do you see the difference here? Is all of a sudden you go from a little group that's trying to get enough money from donors, if you will, to a nation that all of a sudden you've got a revenue stream. It just upped the game. So Iran begins to fund the non-state actors. How in the world do you think the Houthis got those ballistic missiles? They have no capability to have ballistic missiles. It takes a national player to be able to get that kind of armament. And that's what's up the game, if you will. Israel's worst fear is that serious weapons technology could fall into the hands of the Gaza Strip. They're shooting rockets, not very good technology, and Hezbollah. Hezbollah has a lot more rockets, a lot better technology, but still nothing to the national level. In fact, the Houthis are probably the best armed non-state actor around. I mean, they have the primo stuff. You may remember this week, the Houthis, when you see on another map, you'll see how far this is. They shot a missile that landed on the grounds of Ben-Gurion Airport this week. That's some serious high-tech weapon system. So these non-state actors have moved to another area, but what it is, it's sort of like trying to fight Jell-O. In other words, it's not a nation, you can't pin it down. These are non-state actors, and this is a very difficult situation. So that's what Israel is doing right now. Israel's doing well in this conflict, in that Hezbollah has been soundly thrashed by Israel and is no longer a belligerent. Hamas continues to fight, but you may know that this week, Israel changed their tactics in Gaza. So what they had done before is they went into Gaza and they tried to kill the Hamas fighters. There were some civilian casualties, took a long time, and it was not entirely successful. Israel has a different strategy now because they realized they weren't going to get their hostages back by trying to kill the Hamas fighters. So what Israel is doing now is they have said, we are going to go in and occupy Gaza. We're going to take the ground. We're going to push all the population into one corner of Gaza. And then we're going to say, Hamas, give us the hostages. We'll give you some land back. It is a completely different game. But what you see here are people trying to figure out, how do you fight a war against these non-state actors? Do you get a sense of how difficult this is? What Israel is doing right now is trying a completely different tactic to see if they could trade land for hostages. And so it's a different way. And I think the world is watching very carefully to see, how do you battle these non-state actors? Question?
What is Iran's strategy in arming these people groups, non-state actors, particularly as far away as the Houthis?
Yes, I want to hold that for a second because I got a map that will be good to show you that. So let's zoom out one level and let's talk about Syria for a minute. Syria is an interesting little deal. You may know that the Assad regime was overthrown recently, And the group, there were a lot of groups fighting. I mean, the Russians were fighting there, the Syrians were fighting there. There were all these non-state actors, and one group known as HTS, we did a lesson on this, but basically, they ended up coming out on top and overthrowing the Assad regime, which was backed by Russia. I mean, seriously embarrassing for Russia. And so this guy, who used to be called Jalani, is now Ahmed al-Sharaa. He is the ruler of Syria. And he recently, you can see the Al Jazeera press release there, that recently signed a constitution. He's a nationalist. Now, he has ties to ISIS and al-Qaeda. He's not a choir boy, all right? So, and he conquered by fighting Muslim versus Muslim, right, to free Syria. The question became, what's he going to do? Is he going to be another Islamic, is it going to be another Iran? Is it going to be another Islamic State and they're going to be terrorists? The jury's still out, but at the moment, it appears that he is more interested in working for a better Syria than he is being an agitator to the countries around him. So even he's still under sanctions. Syria is still under sanctions by the UN and by the United States because these guys are terrorists. But he appears to be governing like more of a legitimate government. The National Review reported, this was a week ago, that al-Sharaa told an American lawmaker that he would be willing to join the Abraham Accords and normalize relations with Israel. That's a complete and total turnaround for Syria, if indeed that's the case. And it changes a little bit the balance of power. So some of these non-state actors are very successful in gaining control. And then you have to say, well, is this going to be Ayatollah Khomeini? Or is this going to be somebody who wants to make Syria a good nation and really has no interest in killing every Jew they can find? I mean, it's a very different attitude, and we'll see how it plays out for Syria. But right now, Syria has moved out of Iran's orbit. Al-Sharaa owes nothing to Iran for coming into power. So let's zoom out just a little bit. So Iran has political alliances. Iran, basically after the Iraq War, Iran effectively controls Iraq. They did, until a few months ago, controlled Syria. They supported Hezbollah, they supported Hamas, and they supported the Houthi rebels, Islamic rebels. They are also not the government of Yemen, sort of like Hezbollah, but the government of Yemen can't touch them. They're more powerful. And so they were also supporting them. And if you were the United States, this is a little bit of a bleak picture, because your only real ally in the Middle East that you can count on has been Saudi Arabia. And if you remember, the last administration did everything they could to alienate Saudi Arabia, because that's just a matter of fact, because their foreign policy was, we're gonna make Iran the center of our foreign policy. And consequently, Iran's position in the entire Middle East was greatly strengthened. So let's look at what Iran has been doing, and we'll get back to that question. So if you're Iran, anything you do as a nation comes under the rule of international laws. And for example, you can, and the United States did this, you can get economic sanctions. You're trying to run a country, you're trying to feed your people. And when you have sanctions, all of a sudden your people start to get hungry. You can't sell your oil. In other words, the nations of the earth can punish you and punish your people. And if you aren't careful, sooner or later, hungry people say, I don't like these guys ruling, and we're going to rebel. Happened many, many times in history. So as a nation, you have to play in the sandbox with the other kids. So Iran can't just be firing missiles at Israel without some kind of consequences. But if you give missiles to various groups inside Iraq, various groups in Syria, Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis, and they fire them, you can say, wasn't me. Now, is that a thin excuse? Yes, but the rest of the world is willing to accept that excuse and say, look, we don't want trouble. Yeah, they're bad guys, but we really like their oil, and we've got a sweet deal on their oil. It's just practical politics, right? So as long as their surrogates were fighting Israel, then everybody was willing to turn a blind eye and say, boy, Israel, it seems like you have a problem. By the way, try not to kill very many civilians, okay, as you fight these guys. So for Iran, they give them really good weapon systems, but they never attack Israel, so Israel can't really attack Iran, because that would then be an act of aggression, right? That would be like, hey, wait a minute, you're a nation, you attacked another nation, you're in the wrong, Israel. And Israel could say all day long, yeah, but they're arming all these other guys. Go, whoa, 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 that's not a nation, that's just a bunch of bad players. Those guys are acting badly, why don't you go arrest them or something? I mean, the international community doesn't care because it doesn't fit inside the rules of international play because they're not nations, they're non-state actors. So what Iran had done was look how they've encircled them. And by the way, this is pretty impressive. This is some serious technology to fire a ballistic missile from here and land on Ben Gurion Airport. And so they basically have funded and given weapons to all of these non-state actors who would fight on their behalf, and they would never get their hands dirty. That's been Iran's strategy for some time. In the first Trump administration, Trump decided to put sanctions on Iran, saying, hey, we know what's going on here, right? Biden administration chose a different route, chose a negotiated route with Iran, saying, come on, why don't you guys act nice? I'm sure deep, deep down you're really good people. And so now we're back to a different foreign policy, and we'll see how it plays out. So this was a serious situation for Israel. In the meantime, notice the dog that doesn't bark in the night. What's interesting about this is, what is Egypt doing? Are they firing rockets? No. What's Saudi Arabia doing? Are they firing rockets at Israel? Nope. What are all of these other Sunni Muslim nations doing? Nothing. Rhetoric, they're like, ah, we hate Israel, too bad. Israel, quit killing civilians, you guys are awful. A lot of rhetoric, no action. Why? Because they aren't really as worried about Israel. They don't think Israel's gonna bomb them. But Iran has shot missiles at Saudi Arabia. Iran is Shia, and they believe that there should be no nations. Everybody ought to be under the Islamic Kingdom. Saudi Arabia says, I don't think so. Jordan says, I don't think so. Egypt says, I don't think so, because they're Sunni. So what you see is they're not willing to go to war with Iran over this, but they're not piling in. And so you see the potential for a division here, that these Sunni Muslim nations aren't necessarily happy with what Iran is doing. Then comes October 7th. So I just want you to realize and watch what the Sunni nations aren't doing, because it's an opportunity, or at least those who believe in a negotiated settlement think it's an opportunity. October 7th, you get the massacre where the Hamas comes out of Gaza, and then just everything breaks loose. So Hamas is firing at Israel, Hezbollah jumps in, Yemen jumps in. This is an attempt to wipe out Israel. It's betting that the West doesn't have the backbone to come in and save Israel. It was a push to destroy Israel. How has it played out? Israel has won, if you can call it winning, with so many people dead. What's happening to Yemen? Today, the announcement came that Yemen wants a ceasefire with America and won't be firing any more rockets. Is that true? We'll see. But basically, the Houthis have said, enough, you guys are destroying us. Hamas is largely ineffective, and Israel's about to go in and take all of Gaza. Hezbollah is, and they're not even a factor at the moment. Syria is off the table. They're no longer pro-Iran. We've got a new guy running Syria. Iran made the mistake during that war of actually firing at Israel from their own territory. You guys remember this? It's like, we're gonna double down, we're gonna fire hundreds of missiles at you, we're gonna destroy you. Didn't work. So what could Israel then do? Now you can strike them, nation versus nation, but we didn't shoot first. Destroyed their air defense systems. So I just would, my point in this is to say, how have things shaken out since October 7th? Since October 7th, Israel's position is much stronger and Iran is much weaker because most of its proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinian Authority has been smart enough to sit this one out, and the Houthis have just been pounded, and Iran itself has been struck because they crossed the line. And so I just would just point out to you that Iran's position is much weaker today, and the Sunni nations are very happy about that, and they didn't have to lift a finger for that to happen, okay? So questions about that, because I want to zoom out just a little bit more, but this is the answer to why Iran was doing what it's doing. And it was a brilliant strategy. I mean, evil, but I mean, if you're on their side, like, this is a brilliant thing to do. And October 7th was the time to do it. Let's get rid of Israel. And they failed.
Okay, so Iran appears to be the problem child. Why are the rest of the Muslim nations, the Sunni nations that surround them, not willing to remove them?
That is a very good question. There are several answers to that. First of all, the other Sunni nations, I mean, there are a lot of answers to that. First of all, they don't like Israel. Okay, so don't ever confuse I hate Iran to I like Israel, right? But it's hard for them to come together and say, we have a Muslim coalition and we're gonna go to war with another Muslim country. That's tough. Secondly, they don't have the arms that Iran does. Iran, under a totalitarian governments become militaristic very quickly. And Iran is close to having a nuclear weapon. And they believe that Iran would drop a nuclear weapon on a Muslim country if push came to shove. So there are a lot of reasons why they are not willing to take direct action against Iran, at least at this moment. But what I wanted to point out to you is notice what they're not doing. They didn't join in to fight Israel. That's significant.
Several other small nations around, UAE, Qatar, Kuwait, who do they ally with?
Yeah, it honestly, I mean, Qatar is radical. They've been the mouthpiece for Hamas. The UAE is more favorable to America. So they split, you know, different ways. But their role as nations, they're not very powerful. They have a lot of money, and all of those nations fund some of these non-state actors. Some I haven't mentioned to you, but there are a lot of non-state actors causing a lot of trouble. They fund a lot of non-state actors for various purposes.
Okay, how much of a factor in all of this is oil? And are they mostly fighting over land or religion?
That's a good question. Originally, this was a religious fight. And it is still that. But it is much more than that now. And so if you think about it from a land point of view, it's not really about land, because what in the world does Israel have? Land-wise, it's tiny. They have no oil. The only thing that makes Israel important is its history for Muslims and for Jews, and secondarily for Christians as well. It's not about the land. It's about an animosity against the Jews, which began as a religious issue, and now there are all kinds of reasons. you know, just you did this to us, well, you did that to us kind of a thing.
Is the animosity against the Jews the same as the animosity against the U.S.?
The good question. The animosity against the Jews is deeper than animosity against the United States. But the United States, from Iran's point of view, Israel is wayward children who need to be wiped out because they're unbelievers and they're just bad. The United States is the great Satan because they are the ones that come in and fight on the side of Israel. So the statement that the Shiites, Iran, if they destroyed Israel tomorrow, that would not be the end of the story. So they also are against the United States. Israel first, United States second. They've been watching a lot of MTV over there, and they've decided that we are morally bankrupt. They could be right about that. Let's get back to our question. Is war in the Middle East inevitable? Some people will say no for this reason. A moderate strategy, this is the Shiite-Sunni split. These percentages are how many Shiites. So Iran is a Shiite majority. Iraq is a Shiite majority. By the way, Saddam Hussein was a Sunni ruling a majority Shiite country. So that's why Iran and Iraq went to war for 10 years, decades ago. Iran and Iraq have never gotten along because, well, various reasons, but one of them is you are a Sunni ruler oppressing a Shiite majority. And so Iran always thought that they ought to be running Iraq, and now they are. So these are both majority Shiite. Syria is a sizable minority. Lebanon, you notice that you'll see some Shiites everywhere, really. It's not unique to there. Yemen, big group of Shiites in Yemen. But basically, this is the Shia crescent. But remember, 10 to 15% of Muslims, total population, that's it. So you've got Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Turkey, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Malaysia's not on this map, but they're huge country, Oman, et cetera. These are Sunni nations. They don't buy into the Shiite idea of government. And so there's a division there. So if you think there won't be war in the Middle East and we want to avoid it, the moderate strategy is to mobilize the Sunnis to contain Iran. It's a containment strategy. And so that's why you saw the Abraham Accords. The Abraham Accords were the United States brokering a non-aggression treaty, a normalization of relationship. The treaties were actually between these Muslim countries, all of them Sunni countries, and Israel. So you get Sunni Muslim nations normalizing relations with Israel. Doesn't mean they could never attack them. It just says, look, if we're going to do business together, we're not really here to wipe you out. We've accepted the fact that you're here. We don't like you, but you're here. We're not your enemies. Let's go do business together. Does that make sense? That whole idea is a containment strategy. If you could get Syria's not on this map for some reason. Syria's right here. And if you could get Saudi Arabia, which those are the two nations that are the next for the Abraham Accords, are attempting, and Syria, remember Syria's president said we'd be considering it? Look how this map looks all of a sudden. Instead of Iran and their proxies encircling Israel, now what you have is you have all these Sunni nations encircling Iran. And so it's a containment strategy, not to say Sunnis, you should go to war with Iran, but you guys make your peace with Israel and leave Iran stranded on their own and make it clear you can't count on the 85% of the Muslims in the world to help you with this. It's an interesting moderate strategy to use the Sunni-Shiite split to contain Iran. Does that make sense? If that works, the thought is we won't have a war. Let's zoom back out a little bit. Second view on why you might not have a Middle East war is because maybe we'll just have one somewhere else. Think about this. China and Taiwan seems this close. And if so, what will the U.S. do? Very tricky, could fire up into war, especially because Xi Jinping, who's basically premier for life now, is getting older. And, you know, usually the Chinese have a 100-year line. When Kissinger went to meet Mao Zedong, Taiwan was an issue. This is in the 70s, 19 says, 50 years ago. And Mao Zedong said, we aren't going to argue about that. We completely disagree, but we'll win this. We've got 100 years. We got plenty of time. Xi Jinping, not so much, thinking maybe I'd like to be the guy who brought Taiwan back into the fold. So you notice that as you watch the news, I just want this to make sense when you watch the news. When you watch the news, China is being so provocative and so belligerent around Taiwan, trying to find out, will the U.S. really go to war for Taiwan or will they not go to war for Taiwan? In the meantime, Russia decides, well, we didn't do too well in the Middle East. That Syria thing was embarrassing, but actually, I'd rather have Ukraine. And so you've got Russia-Ukraine war going on. Russia has threatened to use tactical nuclear weapons. I mean, this is a big deal. I don't think I have to tell you that. You're familiar with that one. And guess what? Just in case that wasn't interesting enough, Pakistan and India have fired off two nuclear nations, and the rhetoric that they're, the way they're talking about each other is very concerning. There do not seem to be any cool heads in the room on this. So this is kind of a good news, bad news. Good news is maybe there won't be war in the Middle East. Bad news is because it'll happen somewhere else. So honestly, there are serious potential for battle in other places, and it's actually taking a little bit of international attention off of the Middle East, which makes it slightly more likely that the Middle East could see some kind of peace. Does that make sense? I know that sounds kind of backwards, but without China and Russia and all these other nations egging things on and focusing on it, when the attention goes away, might be easier to settle this situation. So that's another point of view on how this might play out a little differently. Third point of view, will there be a two-state solution? Two-state solution says we're not going to have a war. We're going to give Palestine a state that looks like this, and Israel is going to be the rest of it. So Palestinians favor a two-state solution by 60 to 70%, according to polls. Israelis, however, do not. Only 20 to 27% of them favor a two-state solution. And I will tell you why. Actually, it doesn't matter if you're a liberal Israeli or if you are a warlike Israeli. The distance from the West Bank to Tel Aviv is 9 miles. So if the West Bank is its own nation and the West Bank can import weapons from, Iran, maybe, there is no way you can stop a missile from 9 miles away from hitting your capital city. Does that make sense? It's not defensible. And whether you're a liberal Israeli or a conservative Israeli, you would like to be an alive Israeli. And that's why the percentage for a two-state solution is so low among Israelis. Citizens is the idea that it is not a defensible country with a two-state solution. So I know that the international community loves to throw out the two-state solution. I don't think you're going to see this play out simply because that's not how you stop a war from happening. That's how you start a war in the Middle East. Second point is, preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. The most likely indicator of a Middle East war, for them to do what their constitution says, wipe Israel off the face of the earth, is with a nuclear weapon. Israel is a one-bomb country. You set off a bomb in Tel Aviv, you don't make all of Israel uninhabitable, but they're done, they're over. It's game over, they lost. And so keeping Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, if you could do that, you have gone a long way to stop a Middle East war. Because a Middle East war is not likely to be fought with conventional weapons simply because Israel's done such a good job. Remember what we talked about? Iran encircled them. October 7 happens. Now, fast forward a year and a half later, none of them are doing well. Israel has won the conventional war. Does that make sense? But Israel will lose a nuclear war. I mean, has to lose a nuclear war. They're just too small. So Americans, 80% oppose Iran, but 83% of Americans favor economic sanctions to keep them from getting a nuclear weapon. 48%, and that's not trivial, of Americans favor military action to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Israel, 96% of the population opposes Iran. 50 to 60% support military action if the U.S. is with them. So not a lot higher. And the reasoning for that is they don't want to be in the middle of a war. On the other hand, they can't afford for Iran to get a nuclear weapon. It's a very tough situation for any government. And that's what will probably, if anything brings down the Netanyahu government, that's probably what it will be, is the government's feeling that we have to strike and the people saying, we don't want a full-scale war. I mean, that is a very, very difficult situation. But to prevent a Middle East war, it's crucial to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. It seems to me that that ups the percentages greatly, that will happen. So you've got the moderate approach, which is to basically encircle Iran with moderate Muslim nations, Sunni Muslim nations, and force them to be better behaved. You have the two-state solution, which is not going to happen, in my view. I just don't think Israel can afford it. But you do have a concerted effort to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And if you do that, then you basically said, Iran, if you want to start a war, it's going to have to be with conventional weapons. And you just got beat with conventional weapons. So that's not what you'd call peace, but that is stopping a war from breaking out. So this is a bleak picture, but this is what's driving what's going on there now, depending on your philosophy. There's not public support for a war with Iran over nuclear weapons. It may happen, but the public support is surely there's another way to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And we'll just see how that plays out and how it develops over time. So, will there be war in the Middle East? I don't know. But I would say we should do whatever ones of these that we can to keep that from happening. From a religious point of view, Muslims, Shiite Muslims particularly, think that it is inevitable that at some point there will be a war there. And I believe that Christians think that at some point, regardless of what we do, God's plan will come together, and a war there is part of God's plan, but it will work out for good. In other words, it will be God judging, not Israel being defeated. Does that make sense? That it will play out in a very favorable way. So, hopefully, as you tune into the news, I hope this makes a little bit more sense. These are the players, this is where they're coming from, and these are the different strategies. So, before we leave, been a fun series. And by the way, thank you guys for hanging in, because it's kind of complicated, but I think hopefully it helps us understand and it helps us know how to pray. I think prayer is the most effective weapon we have. It's not our military. I'm all about diplomacy, but I think prayer is the most powerful weapon we have. We should pray for the peace of the Middle East. If it's going to happen, God's going to have to do it. So, what are we doing next? Well, this is the last Wednesday night for our church until August. So we don't have classes now until August, because in July, the church is doing something different. We will start off online and in person again in August with kickoff with a new series. In the meantime, I don't talk about this very much, but there is a not-for-profit called So We Speak. There's a passage in 1 Thessalonians that said, we have been entrusted with the gospel, Paul says, so we speak, not to please men, but to please God. So there's a not-for-profit called So We Speak. You can go to sowespeak.com. Great articles there. And so my son and I do a podcast. And if you go to your podcast, whether you use Apple Podcast or whatever thing, and you just type in So We Speak, we have 3 years worth of podcasts. Podcast on every book of the Bible. Right now, we're doing every Wednesday, we release a podcast talking about where's Jesus in the Old Testament, going through the Old Testament books and seeing how they fit with the New Testament. So this isn't an advertisement because it's a not-for-profit. I'm just saying if you'd like to keep up on Wednesday mornings, we drop a podcast and it'll be about some biblical topic. So if you'd like, you can listen to So We Speak through the summer and then we'll kick off in the fall. Yes. Oh, by the way, you can watch them on YouTube also. Thank you. Everybody's podcast now, well, not everybody's, but most of them are also on YouTube. And so if you just go to YouTube, type in So We Speak, you'll see tons of podcasts. When we start in the fall, the church is going to make some changes in locations. This room, because our student ministry is growing so much, we're going to repurpose this room on Wednesday nights for 7th through 12th grade. And that's gonna allow us to take kids out of the school. We have middle schoolers over in the school because we're out of room. Bring them into this building. If you're a parent, you're like, hallelujah. I'm tired of dropping my kids off everywhere in Northwest Oklahoma City, right? So we bring them all into this building. It's gonna be a really good thing for our students and our student and our children's ministry, 5th all the way through 12th. But it will require them to use this room. So where are we gonna go? Well, the church is going to remodel the atrium. We're gonna put in some better sound system. We're gonna put in camera systems. So those of you that watch around the country on video, we will still be live streaming this. So you can still tune in. We'll be live streaming from there. We'll have 600 or so seats in there, plenty of room, I think, for people that come. We're gonna put a barrier in there, so it'll be a nice room. That room actually gets used a lot for teaching. So we will move just right over into the atrium and in the fall. And you'll hear more about that when it comes. So we'll just continue what we're doing. We'll keep studying the Bible. We'll keep live streaming. It'll be on YouTube. It'll be on the website. We just won't be sitting in these chairs. My only deal with Marty was, look, if you're gonna move us over there, my people have to have chairs they can sleep in because I put more people to sleep than sleeping pills, you know? So I want you to be comfortable so you can sleep well in those chairs. I love you guys. I'll see you in August. Thank you.